saying, have a lovely day.
Today is Wednesday, December the 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, President Biden is making a plea to the unvaccinated as the Omicron variant of the coronavirus spreads.
Because Omicron spreads so easily, we'll see some fully vaccinated people get COVID, potentially in large numbers.
And President Vladimir Putin says that Russia has no room to retreat in a standoff with the United States over Ukraine and would be forced into a tough response unless the West dropped its aggressive line. And the UN Human Rights Office is calling on Belarus and Poland to end what it calls appalling treatment of refugees and migrants stranded along their common border and to live up to their obligations under international human rights and refugee laws.
The majority said that while in Belarus, they had been beaten or threatened by security forces, and also alleged that the Belarusian security forces forced them to cross the border.
And policymakers in Ghana exchanged blows over a proposed electronic payment tax. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, President Biden is making a plea to the unvaccinated as the Omicron variant of the coronavirus spreads. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The president says the variant is spreading fast.
Because Omicron spreads so easily, we'll see some fully vaccinated people get COVID, potentially in large numbers.
But he says the winter holidays could be close to normal for the vaccinated. For the unvaccinated,
you're at a high risk of getting sick. And if you get sick, you're likely to spread it to others, including friends and family. The unvaccinated have a significantly higher risk of ending up in a hospital or even dying.
The president made another plea to the unvaccinated to get shots, saying it's their patriotic duty.
You have an obligation to yourselves, to your family, and quite frankly, I know I'll get criticized for this, to your country.
The president says 500 million free rapid tests will be made available, and there will be increased support for hospitals dealing with the strain of virus patients. Ed Donahue, Washington.
And after news that Senator Manchin will not vote for the Build Back Better bill, Democrats are now trying to build back their $2 trillion bill. AP's Mike Garcia has more.
Rocked by Senator Joe Manchin's announcement Sunday that he won't vote for the Democrats' $2 trillion social and environmental legislation, the White House and congressional Democrats are scrambling to somehow rescue the plan. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said President Joe Biden and his aides haven't given up.
We are going to continue to take steps.
Representative Pramila Jayapal, who chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus, called on the president to use
the tool of executive action in every arena immediately.
Wanting to put members on record, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed Monday to hold a vote on the massive package early in the new year. Mike Gracia, Washington.
In a conference call with reporters, Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal, the chairwoman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, says that Democrats can't allow Senator Joe Manchin to scatter their $2 trillion initiative.
Whatever is not accomplished through the legislative path has to be accomplished through the administrative path, and the administrative path cannot wait until the legislative path is done. We need to start acting immediately, and the president needs to start acting immediately.
Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal, the State Department has issued an advisory against American citizens traveling to Ukraine due to increased threats from Russia. AP's correspondent Jackie Quinn has more.
The travel advisory from the State Department cites the military buildup along the border and says Americans should be aware of reports that Russia is planning for significant military action against Ukraine. Further warning, the security situation could deteriorate. The State Department actually has a travel warning for Ukraine already in place due to COVID-19. This new advisory is considered unusual because of the direct warning about the massing of Russian troops along the border. Moscow denies any plans to attack, but U.S. intelligence officials say Russia's moved 70,000 troops to its border with Ukraine and is preparing for a possible invasion early next year. I'm Jackie Quinn.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Belarus and Poland to end what it calls appalling treatment of refugees and migrants stranded along their common border and to live up to their obligations under international human rights and refugee laws. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A UN human rights team visited the region between November 29th and December 3rd to get a first-hand view of the situation. While Polish officials met with the team, Belarusian authorities did not. UN human rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says team members were not granted access to the restricted border area. However, she says they interviewed government officials, civil society representatives, and dozens of refugees and migrants who had arrived in Poland through Belarus. Those interviewed, she says, described the dire conditions on both sides of the border.
The majority said that while in Belarus, they had been beaten or threatened by security forces, and also alleged that the Belarusian security forces forced them to cross the border. Several interviewees said Belarusian security forces had demanded extortionate sums for food and water. They spoke about their fear about being alone in the forest, fear about, even fear of dying because of the difficult conditions there. And one of the migrants said, it's absolute hell for everyone.
The International Organization for Migration says 21 migrants have died along the Belarus-EU border, many from hypothermia because of freezing temperatures. The European Commission accuses Belarus of creating a crisis by luring migrants from the Middle East, Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and other countries to the capital, Minsk, with the false promise of gaining easy entry to the European Union. Throssell says neither Belarus nor Poland wants the refugees and migrants and push them across borders. She says Poland also systematically detains those whom it has not returned to Belarus.
Many of those interviews said they had not been given proper physical and mental health care in detention and had limited contact with the outside world, including with independent lawyers, human rights monitors, and civil society organizations. We remind Poland that detention should be an exceptional measure of last resort and only be used for a limited period of time, if at all.
The UN Human Rights Office is urging authorities of both countries to give human rights and humanitarian actors, as well as journalists, lawyers, and civil society representatives, access to the border areas. It is calling on them and on the EU to respect and protect the human rights of migrants in line with international law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Haiti, the last 12 Christian missionaries kidnapped and held in captivity for 2 months, found their freedom by escaping. That is according to the charity group Christian Aid Missionaries. 17 missionaries were abducted in October by a gang known as 400 Mawozo after visiting an orphanage. 2 hostages were freed in late November and 3 were released earlier this month. Haitian police say that the final dozen of hostages had been found by authorities on a mountain. The mountain is about 37 kilometers south of the capital, Port-au-Prince. A spokesman for the missionary group, Weston Showalter, said at a news conference that the last 12 hostages had plotted their escape and eventually walked several kilometers to a safe point where they could contact authorities.
When they sensed the timing was right, they found a way to open the door that was closed and blocked, filed silently to the path that they have chosen to follow, and quickly left the place that they were held, despite the fact that numerous guards were close by. In the distance, they could see a mountain feature that they had recognized and they had identified in the previous days. They identified this landmark before, and they knew that this is the direction that they needed to go. They also followed the sure guidance of the stars as they journeyed through the night, traveling toward safety. This group included a married couple, a 10-month-old baby, a 3-year-old child, a 14-year-old girl, a 15-year-old boy, 4 single men, and 2 single women. With God's help, protection, and leading, they quickly made their way through the night. They walked for possibly as much as 10 miles. It's a little bit hard to discern exactly how far the distance was, but for many miles, traveling through woods and thickets, working through thorns and briars.
That was Weston Showalter, a spokesman for the missionary group. The ordeal has brought global attention to Haiti's growing problem of gang abduction. The U.S. military said that it had transitioned to an advice and assist mission in Iraq, but the roughly 2,500 service members on the ground will remain, staying on in support roles. For more, reporter Angie Omer spoke to David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. Defense University.
The way that Iran and Iran's agents in Iraq have characterized this is just a smokescreen. They say it's a reflagging. But actually, this is a different unit with different equipment and a different rank structure. So if you're going to fight against Daesh, as the U.S. military returned in 2014 to do, then your rank structure is a bunch of privates, you know, say 30 privates, one lieutenant, and that's it, three NCOs. When you have a train and advise mode, you have a lot of officers, a lot of senior NCOs. You don't have a whole lot of privates. It's kind of like the force structure in Saudi Arabia, where you have more lieutenant colonels than sergeants, because that's a training mission. So we're transitioning from the place where the United States is expecting to fight things like Daesh on a daily basis to a place where a mission where they're focusing on training the sovereign Iraqi security forces and retaining just a very small capability for force protection.
Major General John W. Brennan Jr., the commander of the anti-ISIS task force in Iraq, said in a statement, "In this phase, our transformative partnership with Iraq symbolizes the need for constant vigilance. The U.S. military said its transition from a combat mission in Iraq to one meant to advise, assist, and enable Iraqi forces that are battling the remnants of the Islamic State. Would that be the major role for the remaining U.S. forces in Iraq?"
Look, you know, the Iraqi security forces took 5,000 casualties in the battle for Mosul. And that's hard to sustain. And so, in effect, they're going to need to be guided and rebuilt, not just to fight against Daesh, but also it wasn't Daesh that flew a drone into the Iraqi prime minister's office. So if Iran is going to be a sovereign state, it needs to have military forces who are responsive to the Iraqi government. And the nature of this is to train these forces so that they can actually do that.
Harakat Hezbollah al-Nujaba, one militia group now part of Iraqi government security forces, said it had no trust in any promise made by the United States. It said if U.S. forces do not withdraw at the end of the year, it can be defined only as an occupation. What do you make of that?
Harakat Hezbollah Najaba is paid by the Iraqi state, but those dogs run when their Iranian master whistles. So they're regarded, I think, by any objective observer as agents who are serving not sovereign state of Iraq, but rather Iran. And the Iranian position, which they will faithfully parrot, is that any American presence, probably to include an embassy, is unacceptable. And the reason why they say that is because that's what their Iranian masters have told them to say. But the fact remains, you know, the United States has proven that it is willing to leave Iraq. We left it once in 2011. Iran, on the other hand, is not. And Iran is willing to subvert every institution of Iraqi government. Iran is willing to direct its agents to fire on Iraqi civilians when they're protesting the failure of the government. And as I said earlier, they tried to kill the Iraqi prime minister.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. Defense University, speaking to reporter Angie Omer. And in Australia, a sixth child has died after a bouncy castle accident in the island state of Tasmania. A police investigation is continuing. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
A sixth child who'd been injured in an accident in the Tasmanian port city of Devonport last week has died. 11-year-old Chase Harrison, who died Sunday afternoon, was injured Thursday when a bouncy castle and several inflatable balls were lifted off the ground in high winds at a school event. State Premier Peter Gutwin.
I'm certain that all Tasmanians share with me a deep sadness and a heartache that young Chase Harrison, another child involved in this terrible tragedy, has now passed away.
Two children remain in a critical condition in the Royal Hobart Hospital, while a third is recovering from his injuries at home. Investigators believe the children fell from a height of about 10 metres. Meanwhile, the police inquiry into one of Australia's worst playground disasters is continuing. It could take several weeks to complete. The authorities haven't said how many children were on the inflatable device at the time or if it was tethered to the ground. Tasmania Police Commissioner Darren Hine says specialist help is arriving from other parts of the country.
We have accepted an offer from New South Wales Police to assist in conducting interviews in relation to this tragic event. Four forensic child interviewers will travel to Tasmania today to help conduct interviews with young witnesses over the coming days.
An expert in amusement park safety says some smaller bouncy castles don't adhere to Australian safety regulations and can be bought from overseas retailers for about $600. David Randall from DRA Safety Specialists in the state of Queensland told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that some imports can be unsafe.
Unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of these devices coming from overseas, China, where they're manufactured without adequate instructions on them, and people are unaware of the risks of them being picked up and blown by extreme winds.
A floral tribute to the school children who died and were injured at the school in northwest Tasmania continues to grow. An online fundraising page created to support the families of the victims has raised more than $850,000. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said the tragedy was unthinkably heartbreaking. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And in other news, President Vladimir Putin says that Russia has no room to retreat in a standoff with the United States over Ukraine and would be forced into a tough response unless the West dropped what he called its aggressive line. Putin addressed his remarks on Tuesday to military officials as Russia pressed for response from the US and NATO to reply to proposals it made last week for a binding set of security guarantees from the West. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, Upfront Show, Africa 54 TV Show, Straight Talk Africa, Africa Beat, and many others. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. NASA recently produced an audio of Jupiter's moon Ganymede from data gathered by its orbiting explorer, Juno. Rick Pantaleo tells us more in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Juno is NASA's orbiting mission to Jupiter and its moons. The space agency's Juno team presented the probe's latest findings at the recent American Geophysical Union's fall meeting. Among the highlights offered included the sounds of the Jovian moon Ganymede from data that was gathered as Juno made a close flyby in June 2021. The data that generated these sounds was collected by the spacecraft's WAVES instrument, which is used to monitor electric and magnetic radio waves that are generated within Jupiter's magnetosphere. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says that Juno was within 1,038 kilometers of Ganymede's surface during the close flyby and was traveling at a relative velocity of 67,000 kilometers per hour. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. In more scientific breakthroughs, scientists at the California company are using biotechnology to create an eco-friendly dye as an alternative to the toxic dyes typically used in the production of denim. VOA's Julie Tebow has more.
Despite its classic look, the blue dye used to manufacture denim can be hard on the environment and potentially toxic to workers, some researchers say. Scientists at a company in Berkeley, California have come up with what they say is an eco-friendlier dye, inspired by Mother Nature. They study enzymes that plants use to produce color and program microbes in their lab to mimic that process. The Japanese indigo plant, for example, makes the blue dye molecule in its leaves. Hugh co-founder Tammy Sue.
So we've taken the genetic information from the plant and used it to inform and program our microbes. And so here we have microbes growing on a plate where they're producing indigo in the same way that the dye plant would make indigo.
The researchers grow the microbes in a liquid culture where they replicate and divide to produce the indigo color.
So here we begin the process of developing out how to best grow our microbes, so it's producing the largest amount of dye.
The fabric is soaked in the dye bath and placed on a fabric patter.
And here's the final dyed fabric. This is one of the first Hue indigo dyed lab coats that we made.
Michelle Zhu is the CEO and co-founder of Hue. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
With the advancements in bioengineering and biotechnology, there really is an opportunity to clean up and change these traditional industries for good.
While Hue started its program with indigo for denim, the company plans to create more color options and expand to other industries.
So whether that be for the clothes that we wear, the food that we eat, or the paint on our walls, color is everywhere, and Hue is creating it in a better way, powered by biotechnology.
Hue plans to have its eco-friendly products available to consumers within the next few years. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
And let's go to East Africa in Tanzania, where the country is making concerted efforts to combat the COVID-19 pandemic after almost 1 year of denial under the late President John Magufuli. Since President Samia Suluhu Hassan took office in March, she formed a special committee for COVID-19. In the islands of Zanzibar, the government took similar actions and rolled out a vaccination campaign. And one of the first international NGOs to arrive to the island to help with the efforts was Koja Leadership Forum, led by Dr. Riaz Hassanali from New York. In an interview with my colleague Abdushakul Abud from the Swahili Service, Dr. Hassanali said the campaign is going well so far.
Unfortunately, unlike the Western countries, there is no testing being done, whether it's rapid testing or PCR testing. Those testings are done simply for tourists because of the cost factor. Any tourist who comes into the country is required to get a PCR test or a rapid test. But for the mass, you are not able to afford such a program for them. So you're guessing what the rate of infection is in the country. Nobody really knows what rate it is, nor do we know which variant we're dealing with. We are basing it on anecdotal experiences rather than science.
As a doctor, isn't that dangerous?
I wouldn't say it's dangerous. It's much to my surprise, Zanzibar in particular, I didn't see, the rate of infection as high as one would anticipate, given the fact that the country, doesn't have a strong vaccine policy in place yet. They are recommending that everybody should be vaccinated, but there's also a lot of people who are hesitant, and so they're right now making it voluntarily. They're encouraging people to do it because tourists, and especially tour operators from European countries, are refusing to send their clients to Zanzibar in particular, only because they feel that if the country is not vaccinated and the people are not vaccinated and the hotel's on staff is not vaccinated, that might cause a problem. We know from last year around this time, when the infection rate was high in Russia, a lot of the Russians ended up going to Zanzibar and brought the virus with them. By and large, Zanzibar is protected to a certain extent because it has a younger population and most people are outside. So we don't see as much indoor activities. And as the temperature rises, there's more activities outside, so less likely to get infected. However, when they do get infected, most will find it that it's mild.
So
Those who do get sick.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Those who do get sick end up at government hospitals and just supportive care. That's about the extent of it. They don't have the the kind of treatments that are available in this country.
So what would you attribute to the low infection rate when you said there's no testing, people are not following the steps of protection and all that? What is attributing to the low rate of infection in Zanzibar or in Africa as a whole?
Yes, you know, that's a very good question. And you know, recently there was an article in New York Times and also in Wall Street Journal addressing this particular issue that the Africa, you know, while its vaccination rate is about 6%, and yet you look at the number of deaths, it's really very low compared to the Western countries. And what's the theory behind it? Well, the one theory is that it has a younger population, so they're probably more likely able to fight it easily. Number two, that they are thinking that maybe there was another type of coronavirus that had infected Africa in particular many years ago, and that people have some immunity to that. And then number three, this is a recent theory that came out of Uganda, that they think that people who have malaria, who've had malaria, may have what they call cross-reacting antibodies, which means that an antibody that was for malaria, formed against malaria, may be able to fight corona as well. And that's the theory behind why the rates may be low. It still needs a lot of research to make it an absolute certainty. But for now, those are the three main considerations for why the infection rates are so low in Africa in particular.
That is Dr. Riaz Hassan Ali, head of the NGO Koja Leadership Forum. He was speaking to my colleague, Abdushakur Aboud of the Swahili Service. Lawmakers in Ghana exchanged blows late Monday over a proposed electronic payment tax. The government says the new tax would boost revenue for development, but Parliament has been split over the idea, and fights broke out when supporters tried to force a vote. Kent Mensah reports from Accra, Ghana.
Ghanaians in general, and the opposition in particular, have vehemently opposed the proposed 1.75% tax on electronic transactions, popularly known as e-levy, contained in the 2022 budget. If passed, the law would include taxes on mobile money payment, which is used by 40% of Ghanaians 15 years and older, according to a 2021 data by the Central Bank. Up against a deadline, the government wanted the bill passed under a certificate of urgency on the last day of sitting, but a brawl broke out on the floor when the first deputy speaker, Joseph Osewusu, pushed for the vote. The regular speaker was absent from the session. Opposition MP Mahama Ayariga says the deputy was circumventing normal procedure in an attempt to force the bill through parliament.
The House is governed by rules. And so when we try to undermine those rules, what do you expect the MPs to do? They won't just sit aside and watch the person undermine the rules.
The acting speaker, Osewusu, says he operated within the standing orders of Ghana's parliament and had a right to vote for the bill under consideration.
As long as we can change over, then that advantage is restored. And in my view, and I still hold that view very strongly, that as long as we can change the seat at any time, this should not give us a disadvantage. Otherwise, no proceedings will go on. Why should I come and preside so that I can't take any decision? What is the point?
About 50 lawmakers took part in the brawl. Only one was injured, the Minister of Youth and Sports, who got a cut in the face. The executive director of the African Center for Parliamentary Affairs, ESEPA, Rashid Draman, told a local radio station that Ghana should brace for more gridlock in the current parliament.
I have never seen anything like this. And for me, I've said this since the beginning of the year, that if we are not careful, this is how the if parliament is going to be. If parliament is going to be characterized by a lot of confusion, a lot of gridlock.
Parliament has now been adjourned until January 18 to give lawmakers more room to consult on the controversial electronic levy. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington wishing you a great day ahead.
America, Washington, ba-ba-ba-zip.